I would like you to attend to a passage in the 20th chapter of the Acts, at verse 28. Before Paul left Ephesus, he assembled the elders of the church. You will remember his discourse. And in verse 28, he addresses them in these words: "Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock, over which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers, to feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood." Now this passage is very suitable for our purpose, although it's addressed to more than one person. It contains in it the substance of what I would like to lay upon your mind. I have given the charge to pastor on several occasions. Not, I'm afraid, with much effect. I can only hope that you will ponder these words at some time and think through them before you just let them slip away in a past memory. Now, the terms used in this chapter and here in this verse justify my approach to it from your standpoint. In verse 17, these people are called elders, and in this 28th verse, they're called overseers. The first of these two words, of course, means presbyters, and the overseers means shepherds, watchers. And if you find out the verse and find out the term through the rest of the New Testament, in such passages as the 15th chapter, Philippians 1, 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1, and 1 Peter 5, you'll find that this term overseers is elsewhere rendered bishops. And the Latin form pastor means the same thing. An overseer or shepherd of the flock. That's the point here. Here at Ephesus, of course, there was more than one pastor, as was often the case in these huge New Testament congregations. Therefore, we have here these two ideas. First, the taking of heed to yourself, and then to all the flock, over which you have been made a shepherd. But that word feed flock just simply means shepherd the flock. It includes feeding, but it means far more. First of all, then, may I affectionately remind you that we are required to take heed to ourselves. Take heed to yourself. Paul says the same thing when he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:16, "Take heed unto thyself," and to the doctrine, etc. Now, obviously, unless this exhortation is heeded, we are not qualified to tend a flock. If you take the qualifications of a bishop, putting them together from Timothy and Titus, you are aware, of course, there are 23 qualifications. You must try yourself out by those. We can't talk about all these 23 this evening. But here is one that it seems to me is absolutely outstanding in this question. Take heed to thyself. Because first, we need to maintain a high and vigorous You are called to minister in an apathetic age, in an agnostic age, even in an atheistic age. Almost incredible are the opposing forces. And unless you yourself can learn to live near to Christ and maintain a vigorous, healthy soul, you'll never be able to face up to the burdens and tribulations and trials and temptations which your ministerial position forces upon you. Take heed to thyself, that there may always be a strong, vigorous spirituality. Then other things may be expected to fall into place. And the other thing I would like to mention under this particular head, in taking heed to yourself, have in mind the numerous ministerial temptations that attach to your calling. We can't enumerate these things now, but one thing I would like to stress, and that is the danger of the minister and of the pastor coming to the Bible and reading the Bible as a pastor and as a minister. We have to remember that we ourselves are just poor, forgiven sinners. And if we're always reading the Bible only from the standpoint of what somebody else has to learn, then we're forgetting to take heed to ourselves. Our very profession tempts us almost imperceptibly always to look at the Bible from the standpoint of finding something to say to our flock, so that the book doesn't speak to us. You follow my point, I'm sure. This is one of the greatest of ministerial temptations, as I see it. Far more grave indeed than the temptation of trying to be popular. Far more grave than the temptation of fearing the frowns of men. This danger of becoming a professional minister, so that the Bible is only the textbook for sermons and not God speaking to you. Take it to thyself. But I have to pass on, because in the second place, it requires us to take heed to the flock, because we have been made shepherds of the flock. The flock here is the church, which was purchased with the precious blood of Christ. Now, taking heed to the flock involves at least two things. The feeding of the flock, which is rather like the public ministration, and the tending, which includes and covers the numerous pastoral duties which fall to your lot outside of the pulpit. First of all, feed the flock. This is the public ministration of the word. And feeding them, of course, means just that. It doesn't mean poisoning. A good illustration of what I have in mind comes out of the second book of Kings in chapter 4, when the sons of the prophets went to gather something for the pot and gathered a weed, which turned out to be poisonous. It's very obvious that the school of the prophets didn't have on their curriculum the study of botany, or they wouldn't have made that mistake. Now, this is what I'm getting at. When we are seeking material for our flock, we read and read and read and read. But perhaps without sufficient discrimination. It's all very well to say that the minister should read everything, but my dear brother, life isn't long enough to do that. We have to specialize. We have to discriminate. Because what you seek yourself in as a matter of reading is apt to come out in your preaching. And if what you've been filling yourself up with isn't altogether all that it might be, then it's just possible you may damage the flock. I wish our ministers would keep this in mind. I can tell you oft times from a man's sermon what he's been reading. And it isn't always what I should think he could have read with best advantage. Rather, seek yourself in good reason. You are not to poison the flock, you are. But then on the other hand, this involves, of course, a sufficient diet. Now, Paul, when he writes to the Corinthians, speaks of this, 1 Corinthians 3, 1 and 2, about the need of feeding them on milk, because they couldn't receive anything else. And of course, again, in Hebrews 5, 12 and 14, the same thing is brought to our notice of those who, when they ought to have been able to take strong meat, again, could only receive milk. We need that our churches and our flocks should be strengthened. And they must therefore be fed with a sufficient diet. One of our ministers, now in glory, used to say to me sometimes, well, where the lambs can feed, the old sheep won't starve. But my answer to that is, how can you raise a vigorous church on children? No, no. It's time we had the ability and the grace to bring our people back to the deeper things of God. We have denominationally fallen upon a superficial, general kind of preaching. And many sermons, whilst they're quite consistent with the doctrines of grace, are not expositions of the doctrines of grace. No, we meet this indoctrination of our people, which they had in the days of the Reformation. Would God something would bring our preachers back to this, so that the people of the flock may have the deep things of the Lord laid before them. How else can they grow efficiently? So feeding means feeding and not poisoning, but it also means providing a sufficient diet so that the souls of the people as well as their minds may be prosperous and healthy. I pass on rapidly to the other side, the tending of the flock, those kind of duties which lie outside the pulpit, in your personal contact with your people. And first and foremost, I think here, it ought to be said that you must need and seek from God a great compassion. After all, our people are like ourselves, flesh and blood. Poor, failing, often weak, sinful, troubled with the same kind of inner emotions that we have and the same kind of outside temptations that we have. And if we're going to help them at all, we must abound in compassion. So that whatever happens, we may go on ministering to a compassion that will make it possible for us to shake hands with those whose ears we'd like to box. After all, they're all afflicted, as I say, with the same thing. Christ has died for them, the Father has loved them, the Spirit has quickened them, so that despite all their failings, we must go on deluging them with compassion and tenderness. This involves, I think, two matters. One, the great gift of impartiality. You must pray to God for this because it's an art and not easily attained. If your smile is an eighth of an inch longer when you speak to X than it is when you speak to Z, you'll probably be in trouble. All the same, you must seek this grace of a sturdy impartiality. But this does not mean that you can treat everybody alike, because everybody is not alike. They are persons, they are individuals. And your impartiality must involve your personal sympathy and individual contact with people as individuals. Some members of our churches are like these stately old grandfather clocks that you still meet with in some of the cottages and country places of the land. They steadily tick away the time, reliable, steadfast, never any trouble. And there are people like that, thank God, in our church, that you can always rely on. They never give you any trouble. You will bless God for their constant presence, for their loyal work and service. But there are others, rather like those German alarm clocks that one could buy when I was a boy. They will work if you set them just home. Perhaps you have to lean the back of it, or you have to lean them forward, or put a bit of cardboard under one foot. Well, if people need to be set just so, you must have the art of setting them just so. Because they're all individuals. You need the alarm clock, and you need the stately grandfather clock. They're all in the shop, you see, they're all machines. They all belong. And then, of course, there are the times when the sickness of the souls and of the bodies will become your concern as well. Principally, the sickness of the soul, but also the body. The sights and the sounds of the sick room require a lot of grace. And once more, the abounding compassion and sympathy which your ministerial life demands. Now, Mrs. Baldwin, I feel sure, can draw from these remarks those things which will specially concern her. For in seconding you, she will often be able to put her foot on a spark that might be dangerous otherwise, or to underline your ministry and to back it up. She will find these tasks sometimes difficult, but always delightful if she shares your compassion for the sheep. Now, finally, as long as God sustains you in your office, you must seek a great loyalty in your task. When Paul wrote these words, or said these words, you'll notice in the following verses, he said that he knew that wolves would come in after he had gone. So I want to say just that, in this day, the wolves are running. The Bible is attacked, the Savior is dethroned, his blood redemption is born. And the churches are beset by lost spirituality, apathy, worldliness. The wolves are running. But we are to shepherd the flock. The hireling, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming, and leaveth the sheep and fleeth. But since the wolves are running, your task, till God takes it away, is to be there. And after all, as Peter says in his first epistle, chapter 5, verse 4, when the great shepherd shall appear, you will receive the crown of glory that fades not away. And even if you didn't get a crown, you would still want to shepherd the sheep. If I know.